It was 3 a.m., the summer of 1968, a magical Southern California night. I was 16 years old and had spent the weekend partying at a friend's house in Santa Monica. I was restless. I wanted something to do. A young blonde man I'd met only an hour before invited me to go for a ride up into the hills. We jumped into my green Austin Mini Cooper, my companion at the wheel, and took off for Tuna Canyon, one of the most desolate spots in the Santa Monica Range. The road snaked up into the mountains to an elevation of about 1,500 feet. We can see the entire Malibu coastline laid out before us. The higher we climbed, the more treacherous the curves of the road became. But we were paying little attention, high on a potent amphetamine we'd taken an hour before. On the last curve before the top, he didn't respond quickly enough, and the right front tire plowed into the soft gravel along the shoulder. The car lurched wildly as he wrestled with the steering wheel in a frantic effort to regain control. He slammed on the brakes. I heard the tires shriek, and then we were skidding off the pavement and hurtling over the edge of the cliff, plunging down into the darkness below. I recall only fragments of what happened next. I do know that time slowed down. The night sky was swirling beneath my feet instead of above me. The horror of my predicament never really registered. Instead, something shifted. I found myself standing in a sort of tunnel, feeling safe and secure. Although I could hear the wind rushing past the open windows of the car, I was now suspended in this peaceful sanctuary while we fell through space toward the canyon floor. I looked around the tunnel now surrounding me. Its translucent walls appeared to extend endlessly in both directions, comprised of a swirling, vaporous material. I felt utterly at peace, contained and self-contained, in a place that seemed to be going on forever. The car bounced off huge boulders, turning end over end as we plummeted down the mountainside, and yet I never perceived that I was in the slightest danger. Protected by the shelter of the tunnel, I remained in a void, not knowing if this was life or death. As abruptly as I'd been pulled into it, I was jolted out of the tunnel and back into the present, just as the car crashed down on solid ground. With a high shuddering bounce and a grating sound of steel against rock, we careened to a grinding halt, the front wheels of the car projecting over a narrow ledge. We were precariously balanced, actually teetering on the precipice. We had to get out of there fast. A live oak tree was our only available support. Without looking back, I grabbed onto its branches and managed to pull myself out of the mangled car. My companion close behind, we scrambled up the side of the cliff. We should have been killed. Instead, we were walking away with hardly a scratch, and already the image of the tunnel haunted me. Very relieved to be on solid ground again, we were soon able to hitchhike a ride down the winding canyon roads back into the city. I have little recall of that trip. I replayed the accident over and over in my mind, unable to account for how we could still be alive. Only a miracle could have saved us. For my parents, what happened that night was only the latest in a series of drug-related calamities in my life. I was their only child, and they were frantic. Before the car wreck, my parents had done all they could to get me some help. I just wouldn't listen, was convinced my parents were incapable of truly understanding my inner struggles, perhaps because I didn't understand them myself. I felt no one could understand me anyway, how I sometimes knew things about people before they said a word, or how I made accurate predictions about the future, often unhappy ones. My father never gave these predictions much credence, or even said anything about them. But for my mother, my predictions made her uneasy, fearful that such talk would keep me from being normal. But my predictions made me no more comfortable than they made her. In fact, I would have done anything to shut them off. And drugs could do that for me. The next morning, my parents packed up my things and sent me to stay with some of their close friends in Malibu Colony. While they were deciding how best to help me, they insisted I remain there, isolated from my own friends and away from drugs. Disgruntled and moody, I settled into the beach house as best I could. We Refusing to talk to anyone, I installed myself on the living room sofa and turned on the TV. There I lay, mindlessly watching a Star Trek episode. Soon, however, my parents' friends barged in and introduced me to a neighbor. I was hostile when I looked up at him, but I quickly did a double take. Jim was a tall, lean man in his mid-40s, with full, curly white hair and a white beard. Almost before I knew it, Jim was sitting on the couch beside me and gently asking me questions about myself. I instantly connected with Jim, felt some sort of magical alliance between us. But there was no way in the world I was going to admit that to anybody. Eventually, he said goodbye, got up, and left. The next morning, my parents issued me an ultimatum. Either I had to agree to go into psychotherapy now, or they'd send me to live with relatives on the East Coast. I viewed therapy as a farce, but since I wanted to stay in Los Angeles at any cost, I reluctantly consented.